Right, good afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back from lunch. I'm David Ottley. I'm sort of retired at Lancaster University Management School now. I've been carefully selected at 3 minutes' notice to chair this session, mainly, I think, because I have been the author of one of the frameworks on business performance management. Actually quite pleased to see the title was Business Performance Management, not just measurement, so that's a good start. The title is Feel the Tensions, so I'm gearing up to feel those as the frameworks get criticised, so we'll see how we get on. Rick Payne and his colleagues are going to, all from the English Institute of Chartered Accountants in various forms. You can read their bits of biography at the front of the list. And Rick's going to give a short presentation and interview his two colleagues to get things going. And there will be time for pertinent questions. So don't let me get started afterwards. Get your questions lined up. So over to you, Rick.
Thanks, David. And always a pleasure to be here at MARG presenting to you. Great to be back. In preparing for this session, I came across a great, fantastic page on Wikipedia called A List of Humorous Units of Measurement. We'll argue that measurement of the actuals in business is perhaps more important than some would think. And taking inspiration from the Wikipedia page, maybe measuring actuals can be more fun too. On the wiki page, we have units of measurement such as the canard, which measures quackery. We have the Warhol, which measures fame in units of 15 minutes. But the one I'm most conscious of is the microcentury. This is a term coined by the mathematician John von Neumann to denote the maximum length of time that you can hold people's interest in a lecture. And he calculated this to be 52 minutes, 55.69 seconds. Now, we've been allocated quite a lot less than that, so we should be fine. But I've got a lot to cover, so I'm going to go quickly, and I'm going to stick pretty closely to my notes. So, for some time, ICAW has been looking at the subject of business performance management, or BPM for short. And our business members, who make up more than 50% of ICAW's membership, many of them working as CFOs, finance directors, financial controllers, etc., tell us that BPM is the most important topic for them. So what I'm going to do is provide an outline, the sort of abstract side of our framework and our thinking behind it, how we built it up. And then, David says, I'm going to interview Stephen Ibbotson, who's head of the faculty, head of business at ICAEW, and previously corporate controller at Avon and many finance director roles at Avon too. And Philip Smith, Dr. Philip Smith, who's been driving this work and research that we've been doing around business performance management and is writing the report on the subject, ably assisted by Emma Riddell, who's in the audience as well. So our business performance management work builds on our finance function framework. And it occurred to me that we presented this framework way back in 2010 in this very room. And it's doing very well, quoted by academia as well as practice. And we highlighted three activities in there that really relate to business performance management: what the organization is doing, management and control, and strategy. And there seem to be two main BPM approaches: the business success book approach and the performance frameworks approach. And as you know, there are no shortage of business success books, which on the face of it claim to be well-researched, and they provide some very helpful stories and anecdotes which we might find useful. But when we dig a little deeper, we find that some of the information is contradictory, like stick to the knitting or versus experiment in multiple types of business. It's also striking that appearing in some of these books becomes the kiss of death for the organisations concerned. Even the Three Rules book, which is one of the sort of latest in the genre, which claims excellent research rigour and claims the research high ground, has been no exception. For example, Lords, Abercrombie and Fitch, which has reported flat or falling like-for-like sales for the last 13 quarters. Alternatively, you can focus on frameworks, which help us think through the issues of business performance management for ourselves. And this is our preferred approach. We've been influenced by Anthony's distinctions between strategic, management and operational control, Simon's levers of control, and Kaplan and Norton's strategy maps and balanced scorecard. But we owe our biggest debt to David and his colleague Aldonino Ferreira for their paper on frameworks in 2009. And one of the things that struck us with these frameworks is that they all do point to the inherent tensions in business performance management. Simon sets out to reconcile the conflict between creativity and control. Kaplan and Norton were aiming to overcome misalignment within organisations. And the Otley framework looks at coming up with a comprehensive set of good questions. So they all point to tensions in some way. Now, developing our approach has been a struggle, and I'm sure SEMA have had similar struggles and issues in putting together their management accounting principles, which are covered in the next session. And hopefully that session is going to help us better understand the choices that SEMA made, which will in turn help us. The first struggle is passing the NOT test. So in SEMA's four principles, we have information is relevant. But would you really produce deliberately information that wasn't relevant? You'll see our framework is more descriptive and challenges people to think things through. Is that a more useful way forward? So that's a useful discussion for later. Secondly, the detailed practices section of SEMA's principles contain many prescriptions that are supposed to apply to all organisations universally. But given the level of formality in these practices, we see the very real possibility that many types of organisations will tie themselves up in bureaucracy and jeopardise creativity and innovation. We've chosen not to be prescriptive, believing that all organisations have to adapt to their unique circumstances. And lastly, as professional bodies, both ICAW and SEMA want to promote the skills and strengths of their members, understandably. But we've chosen not to specify who carries out BPM work, believing that the strongest will overcome the challenges, whatever their backgrounds. The SEMA principles, I have to say, feel a little bit more like a marketing document, rather than something trying to arrive at a consensus across professional bodies. For example, everything becomes management accounting, including tax, financial reporting, and treasury. And management accountants are referred to throughout the document. Would anyone expect IFRS to imply who can undertake the work? So I'm really looking forward to discussing these struggles and questions that are not easy to overcome given all the pressures that people are under. So as I mentioned, we're very indebted to all the frameworks and Otley and Ferreira's work in particular, but there are a few things that we wanted to develop further. First of all, we wanted to put the inherent tensions and challenges of using BPM, such as differing stakeholder interests, front and centre, not sweeping them under the carpet like some inconvenient niggles. We also place greater emphasis on the role of information. It's not easy to put information together, and then getting it used in the right way is also a challenge. And lastly, our framework shows the iterative nature of achieving and re-achieving acceptable, never perfect, BPM processes, which need to be adapted to changing circumstances. So as you can see on our first slide, we put the tensions of BPM on the same footing, an equal footing, with the BPM framework itself. And it's the interaction between these tensions and the framework that lead to consequences and actions. So for example, it would be nice to think that senior managers totally understand the techniques that we might use. So you may be an expert in economic value added, and you present this analysis to a line manager. Now, if the line manager doesn't fully understand the analysis, you've got some choices to make. Do you dumb it down risking that you don't get the right amount of challenge? Do you try to educate, risking people just getting turned off and seeing the analysis as too complex? Or do you build trust such that the recommendations are just accepted by line management, risking us being held accountable for decisions that should rightly be made by line management? So we think our framework serves as a guide to help you clarify your thinking and against which you can map your existing processes and assess their completeness, alignment, and effectiveness. The framework comprises three main settings, and I'm going to describe each of those in a bit more detail in turn. But to bear in mind, this all takes place in a changing operating environment, and we need to adapt to changing circumstances, what we're doing here. So starting with organisational setting, and to misquote Alice in Wonderland, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. So we start with the organisation's vision and mission. These may or may not be written down, and they may or may not be understood by all organisational actors. Vision and mission influence strategy, and we see strategy as often about making tough choices. So, for example, Facebook had a fantastic setup on PCs and laptops and Macs, which everyone was using very, very successfully. But they knew that their mobile applications were pretty rubbish. So they pretty much turned off development on the website and devoted all their resources and management energies into developing mobile applications. Now, at the time, that was a really bold decision to make, but it clearly has shown to be the right one. Now, any strategy is pie in the sky if you don't have or can't garner the appropriate resources, be they financial, human, physical, and so on, and create workable organisational structures and cultures, the last three headings we have under organisational setting. Implementing and refining strategy requires the provision of information. Easy to say, and as we've heard, often difficult to do. And we've heard a lot about the potential of systems, but how we somehow have not necessarily realised that potential. And under this heading, we also include the approach to planning, target setting, the range of analytical and reporting techniques, such as value chain analysis, discounted cash flow, balanced scorecard, etc. But you need to choose what is most useful to your individual business. The point I want to emphasise here, though, is this role of actuals, which sometimes gets downplayed. Under pressure from consultants to take advantage of big data, dashboards, fantastic visualisations, you can lose the importance of actuals. But they're the foundation of the visuals. They're the foundation of the projections in the future and the foundation of knowing whether your strategy is working or not. And we should also bear in mind that even if there aren't clear mistakes in the data, that they are based on numerous economically debatable conventions, assumptions, and estimates. The turmoil caused at Tesco's is a salutary lesson in how important the actuals can be to a business. Clearly, doing any of this is a waste of time if it doesn't have some impact on the organisation, and learning may be one of those impacts. And the impact may be to confirm the strategy is working okay or highlight the need to change tack. It may be that operationally things are working or not working, or indeed it might be that the BPM system itself needs to change. Are we measuring the wrong things? Are we driving the wrong behaviours? And we also need to think about how is this system impacting on staff motivation. And that's just a slide which shows them all on one page. The case studies I'm going to discuss with Philip and Stephen are sort of more of the meat on the bone. But what I just wanted to do quickly was talk about how we've classified the tensions. I'm going to get some more detail from Stephen and Philip. So under organisational setting, we know that organisations operate under conditions of uncertainty. They have to deal with multiple stakeholder interests. Maybe shareholders want increased profitability, while management just wants to grow the size of the business to improve their status. We know that if you look at an organisation through an operational lens versus a financial lens, you get a different view of the world. Look at the dot-com boom, where the user numbers, the click-throughs were showing fantastic potential for businesses, and yet the financials were showing year after year of financial losses. We get many people telling us that the focus on quarterly earnings means that you can't plan for the long term. And clearly your BPM capabilities are limited to your staff capabilities. We've heard more than enough about the tensions in systems. We have trade-offs when we choose our analytical techniques. Should we choose ABC or target costing or absorption costing? There are always trade-offs to be made in the selections we make. In terms of projections, there's a trade-off between do we make our targets stretching or do we make them achievable? And there are pros and cons, again, of each one. Measurement, as I've said, is not always straightforward. There are trade-offs perhaps between speed and accuracy. What do we need to do? How do we weigh that up? And then we need to evaluate and present our analysis in a meaningful way. But how do you pick out the signal from the noise? So with that abstract sort of introduction, I'm then going to interview Stephen and Philip on the sort of so what of all of this. And we're really going to focus on the tensions, as we've said. So, Philip, first of all, if I can turn to you. Philip is a turnaround specialist and worked in many different types of business.
Mainly SMEs.
So we've got a combination of big companies and small companies here. Can you just give us a little bit of background to the case you're going to talk about?
Yeah. Basically, I'm talking about a domiciliary care agency. They've been in the news quite a lot. And these agencies provide care workers to people that require them, funded by the local authority. So that's the basis of the case that I'm going to talk about. This company was actually purchased by private equity, who were trying to do a buy and build strategy. So they purchased this business on a fairly highly geared basis with heavy bank funding. So what you've got here is a mixture of a wide range of stakeholders. You've got the financial stakeholders, which are the private equity and the banks, and then obviously the more care-oriented customers, the customers and the council who are trying to provide the services. So you've got a mix of people doing it. Now, what happened in this instance is that when the business plan was set up, the economic situation changed. There was less money coming from central government. So that actually triggered a financial downturn, so that the results that they were intending to achieve weren't achieved, and the banks were breaking the covenants. So that triggered the banks into taking an IBR and getting involved to try and say to really focus on the financial outcomes. But the problem with that is then you're then triggering a difference in interest between the stakeholders, because you've got the bank and the private equity. And the private equity were very much supportive of the bank because they didn't want the bank to maintain control. So they were trying to keep their investment in the business. So that's sort of that they're saying that's the most key bit. So how did this potential tension play out? The issue was that the focus then moved on to the financials rather than the operations, so that everything became a focus. So, and a good example of this was the supervisors who were meant to be providing the quality care for the care workers and making sure that they delivered. They were effectively made to they were reduced in the numbers, and their sole concern was to make sure that the rotas were done and that the work was achieved, so that there was a sufficient quality of care for the sufficient income to meet the targets.
So you're getting a trade-off between care and yes. The actual targeting of what was effectively financial to get enough people in place.
Yeah, that's right. So the financial basically came ahead of the care. Because of the financial pressures, the idea was to reduce the overheads and reduce the costs. So all the supervision and the training went away, and what was just left was the optimising of the financials. And all the financial and the metrics that everybody was looking at were just the weekly returns of how many how much income we were getting from the care workers, and at the board levels, what was the EBITDA, and were we meeting with the bank covenants and all of that. So effectively, you've got a totally sort of privileged situation where the finance is taking over from the operational. So in our terms of tensions, you've got a change in value of the stakeholders caused by the changing economic environment. And also you've got the financial information becoming more important in the short term than the operational information. The problem, though, is actually there's no point in having a care business unless you provide care. But of course, that's not an immediate indicator, because it's almost the care was provided on a default basis. Provided nobody says it's not being provided, it is being provided. So you can carry on quite a long way actually focusing on the financial management, which actually seemed to be going quite well and was missing all the targets. But
yeah, that was one of the key points. You actually, on one level, the financials were showing a really good business.
Yeah, absolutely.
But underneath it, these other...
That is crazy results that we had actually... Well done, lads, you've met all your financial targets, but underneath it, you've got a problem that the care's actually providing away. And looking at deteriorating, yes. And going back to the key success factors, you're then focusing on the wrong thing, because the key success factors of a care business at the end of the day has got to be the provision of the care. So you've got this warped movement in the business performance as a result of the tensions playing out.
And it was the private equity business largely ownership driving this?
Well, it's the banks driving it, but the private equity... I mean, because one of the sort of potential solutions to this would be to say, look, this isn't working, should we actually exit out of it and pay the bank off? But obviously, with the private equity coming in and their position of controlling the board, their sole interest was to keep the business going and hoping it might mysteriously turn around. So again, there's another sort of tension there, and actually quite a tension between the bank and the private equity, because the private equity was saying, just keep the thing going and make sure it's all right and keep the bank happy and hope that the service issues don't sort of come back and bite you.
Right. So you've got different pressures going on, reporting different levels of information with sort of differing consequences,
yes.
Some being missed.
Yeah.
How did this sort of, what were the outcomes in the end? How did things end up?
Well, as I said, I mean, it went on relatively successfully for a period of time, but one of the major stakeholders is the CQC, which is the Quality Care Commission, and eventually they picked up that the service levels that were being provided weren't sufficiently, didn't meet the targets. But again, so this is really a performance management issue, because clearly what the best way forward for the business would have been to make certain that they knew that they were meeting all the CQC targets before they actually happened. And then, of course, you get this sort of strange reversal, because when they don't meet them, the reaction of the management, and again, another tension coming here, because the management are looking after their own position, is to try and actually just bat away the CQC reports by making short-term adjustments so that they can get their way out of the system without it causing a problem. So it's, can we talk the CQC inspectors right that they don't close us down? And that means we can all keep our jobs. So there's a whole interplay of conflicting tensions which go against which would be a nice idea, that we'd be focusing on the quality of the care and managing it efficiently and giving a good return to the bank, which is the sort of ideal of the situation.
And what was the ultimate outcome?
Well, it carried on for some time, and I was in a bit of a situation, because I was actually the private equity nominated director. So, and I was sort of trying to say, well, we should sell this. And they're saying, well, we don't want to sell it, because that's going to crystallise a loss, which isn't a good idea. And we're raising money and all these good things. So they sort of ignored that and just said, let's carry on. So I actually resigned, because I couldn't sort of carry on. And a year later, the situation finally got worse, because the staff morale weren't down, and obviously the council wasn't very good, so you're getting less work, so the whole thing became a shrinking business. And eventually it was sold at quite a loss to the bank, okay. And it sort of carried on, so there wasn't a complete disaster.
Okay. And the lessons learned, just very quickly.
Well, I mean, it's the changing environment then triggers tensions. It's the sleepwalking into disaster thing, I think, that's actually sort of quite interesting, because Now I'm describing it, it all appears quite clear. At the time, you're just following one day after the other, and apparently doing quite rational actions. But you've got the changing environment, that upset the stakeholder tensions, which then meant there was a bigger focus on the financials, trying to run it through the financials, where it's really the operationals that runs it. And then that runs through, there's no investment in the systems, and so that sort of fails away, and then you're looking at the wrong things. So the whole gamut all just gets
interconnected stuff.
Comes down. And it is quite interesting, and business performance management can't always manage successfully. I mean, I think that's another lesson. Actually, some businesses don't work, otherwise they wouldn't be going bust, and they wouldn't be completely different now from what they were 30 years ago. So the whole idea of do the business performance, you get success, everything's going to work, doesn't necessarily happen.
Excellent, thank you. So moving on to Stephen, which is a different context altogether. Maybe you can give us some background to the case you're going to talk about.
Yeah, I will, Rick, and thank you. It's actually a case that, or similar, I'm sure, to one of the things Mark mentioned. So at the company, we decided to move from a very decentralised model.
This is Avon, by the way. Yeah, sorry.
I was never going to mention it. a very decentralised model where each country did its own sales, marketing, manufacturing, distribution, to much more of a matrix regional model. And the particular area I was going to talk about was the supply chain, where instead of having each country manufacture everything, we'd have built one mega factory which was going to build everything, make everything, a regional distribution network. And it was a business performance management project. The idea or the business case was that we would save money, you know, reduce cost. We would improve service because the manufacturing would be much more efficient. You'd be able to move from one place to the other where there are shortages of product, and reduce working capital, particularly in inventory. And it was clearly a big project. It was complemented by an ERP implementation, lots of system and process change, lots of people change too. A lot of new people were brought in because it was felt that, particularly in the supply chain, the existing people couldn't manage that more modern approach to it, and different KPIs, different measures through it. So that was the background.
So how did things play out?
Well, there were a lot of tensions. Otherwise, I suppose I wouldn't be giving this update. Interestingly for me, I was the UK FD when it started, and I was the European FD when it finished. I'm not quite sure what that says to anything, but I'll give you two illustrations of where we really had tensions, and I'll link them to the framework. The first one was around measures. So within this new European-wide supply chain, they measured service by looking at unit fill rate. And by unit fill rate, I mean if demand is for 100 units and the manufacturing entity can supply within the schedule 99, that's a 99% fill rate. Or if it's 50, it's a 50% fill rate. However, the individual companies measured something called order fill rate. Now, order fill rate is actually a much more complicated indicator to fulfill. It means that every order that you send out is correct. If you don't, it's not 100%. And to be correct, every product has to be in there. That's one of the criteria. Also, it's not damaged or anything like that. So that's much tougher to get. Now, in the manufacturing area, or the regional supply chain, they were getting unit fill rates in the low 90%. And a lot of the people, I said new people had come from retail and from FMCG, a lot from Unilever actually. And they thought, wow, this is great. You know, in a retail environment, these are really good numbers. The problem was that when you actually do the math, low 90% translates to something like an 18-20% order fill rate. So only one in five orders that went out, because most orders had 100, 150 products in them, only one in five that went out was actually a complete order. So each representative would get this order and say, oh, they screwed it up again. I have 2 weeks to get this order to me, and I could go down to Tesco's and buy it, in the UK, obviously. This red lipstick, but, you know, Avon have 2 weeks and they still get it wrong. So it's a huge tension. And in fact, I meant to mention this earlier, but most of the tensions I came across were between people, or involved and manifested in people, obviously, as I think Phillips did too. So you had one group thinking, I'm measuring this brilliantly, I'm doing really well, pat myself on the back, I get my bonus, everything's great. And the other going, this is a total disaster. You have to get up to literally 98-99% order fill rate to get a reasonable, unit fill rate to get a reasonable order fill rate. So that, to me, illustrated different measures, and linked to those measures were reward and recognition, clearly. The second tension I was going to mention, and because there's so many I can't mention. I'm not sure. Well, I describe this as operational. You may have a different choice on what it is. But Christmas, Avon would import a lot of products from the Far East, toys and gifts and things to sell at Christmas. And clearly there's a long supply chain there. And demand is hard to predict. And what we found would happen in certain instances would demand would be much higher than we expected. So the regional supply chain group would say, oh, well, never mind, that's too bad, isn't it? Where the people in the markets would say, we've got to air freight this in, and we've got to meet demand, because if you look at it holistically, the total cost of the business will be much greater if we don't. We'll cheese off our representatives, we'll get the stuff in later, send it them after Christmas, they'll just send it back, we'll throw it away. But we'd have to incur a big air freight cost. But again, and perhaps you could call this a measurement tension, the people in the regional supply chain said, oh no, that's going to racket up my costs, and that's very bad for my individual scorecard, and the company would say, the country would say, yeah, but net-net, it's actually good for the company. Yeah. So two different tensions.
So there. Levels of aggregation is something that we don't often talk about, but becomes very important.
Well, that's one of many aggregation instances I came across.
So just what, again, were the key lessons learned before I throw it open to
The good news is, and I suppose I should give some good
news. We have to have some good news. Maybe this too is miserable, man.
It was a tough few years, and the transition, and maybe this is typical of projects, because I've certainly seen it in projects, the transition is often worse than the either the beginning or the end. I don't know, Philip, if you've seen that too. In the end, amazingly, we were able to reduce cost, improve service, and reduce inventory. And reducing inventory and improve service is clearly a great thing. But the things we learned were pretty obvious. You know, make sure your measurements are aligned. You don't measure one group on something that's almost diametrically opposite to another. Secondly, try and look at things in the whole. De-aggregate your point, either by market or by component. So there were good learnings coming from.
And why, you say it's obvious, but when you're in the thick of it, perhaps you don't see the obvious.
Well, like Philip, you think you're making rational decisions as you go along each day. You're not trying to screw things up. So it is clearly a lot easier to see things in retrospect. And you can also, and I don't know if you saw this, you can actually see it at some instances. You have sort of blinding lights saying, well, this isn't really working. If only we got this, it would be so much better. But we haven't and we can't, so we've just got to try and work towards that. So it's that transition point I made before. It does take time.
Thank you. So we've got a little bit of time for questions from the audience, either on the framework itself, the cases you've heard about. David, I think you were going to find some hands.
It's me again. Ramji Balakrishnan, University of Iowa. I was a bit surprised that neither of you emphasized or spoke a great deal about the role of how these measures got translated to incentives via compensation contracts, whether implicit or explicit. Even if you measure something really well, if it is not set at the right target level or if it is not appropriately incentivized, you're going to trigger perverse behavior. There is a lot of research that kind of demonstrates this. Is this something that, can you expand on what is the role for incentives in these cases that you were talking about?
I'm sure both of you can. Incentives played a huge part.
Yes. I mean, I think in the tensions, we didn't really sort of pull that out, but under staff capabilities and interests, I mean, it's trying to align, I mean, the whole agency issue of trying to align the staff so that they're actually working for the organisational goals. and what are the organisational goals, and do incentives have a perverse response or not, is a huge issue. And again, it plays out differently depending on the context of what it is. So it's very difficult. What works in one situation doesn't necessarily work in another situation.
And I think each of those, we talked about stakeholder interests, and a lot of those were linked into incentives. So private equity had a different incentive to the Care Commission. So incentives were a huge part of it, which maybe we didn't bring out strongly enough.
Yeah, well, in my example, very clear. Perhaps I wasn't as clear as I thought I was, but for where the regional supply chain organisation was incentivised on its targets, so reducing cost, i.e. not incurring air freight, was a very clear incentive for them. And I don't want to spend money on air freight because that will come out of my bonus. I mean, it's that basic. Whereas the company is saying, no, the individual market, I want to look at the whole thing because I'm interested in my bottom line profit, and it's much tougher to break that up and give people incentives for individual components of that and make sure they align than it is to have one incentive for a clear and obvious target. But critical. No, absolutely not. No, of course you're not surprised when it impacts.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of view is that how it plays, it's not a surprise at all, and it's central to the tensions that we're talking about, is really, I think, the point I'm saying. So, in a way, in the case study, the specific one that I sort of talked about, I mean, the work's based on a lot. That's just we just use that as an illustration, and in a lot of the other cases, actually, it becomes a lot more significant and important. I have to say, from my sort of work experience and from the hold of the thing, the actual role of people is completely central to all of this and how they're aligned, and they're often the trigger of other tensions that play through, because obviously, you know, when you're depending on the perspective of how you look at the figures, some person's going to look at it one way and another person's going to look at it another way.
And I think it's just, you're never going to get a perfect answer, so there's always going to be some element of tension. You can't, although you can anticipate them, you can't come up with a perfect incentive system. You're sort of looking for the least worst option. To a large extent.
And it's more difficult in either a transition or a dynamic environment where things are changing all the time. And clearly we weren't naive enough to think this was going to be perfect, and we budgeted accordingly. But it's how that manifests when you actually start to do it is where the tensions really show.
Adrian Ryan, previous speaker. I agree with the point about rewards. I won't labour that, except I will say, when I've been implementing performance management programs, the single biggest blocker is the reward structure. And it actually only works very well when the reward structure has nothing to do, as much as it can have nothing to do, with the provision of management information. I call it management information, but it's the same thing as business performance management. On the framework itself, a couple of other things that occurred to me that weren't immediately obvious. If you think about creating a business performance management structure or framework that focuses on business drivers, competitor actions, legislation, regulatory, and risk management. So I think those are aspects that from my point of view, at least, perhaps ought to be more obvious. Second point I just wanted to raise was for me, business performance management, there's a choice that you have to make when you want to create a framework and implement something. Do you want something that will effectively be scorecards measuring performance, which then, of course, can be related to reward structures and targets? Or are you after management information for business decision-making? Because I think, actually, those two things tend to a little bit go in different directions. And actually, the case studies are a case in point.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, just an interest, that We agree with you. We had a very short period of time to cover what is a much more comprehensive framework. Risk is a really interesting one that we've debated long and hard, and we've sort of seen it as sort of flowing through the whole thing. So your strategy has risk implications. The way that you use information has risk implications. So we didn't want to pull out risk. It's sort of inherent part of it. We'd certainly agree that the things you're talking about, understanding business, the drivers of the business, is all there in that strategy stuff. Key success factors and so on. So they are there in the framework, but we had limited time to really pull those out.
Yeah, if I can make a sort of just a general point, because I think it's interesting everybody's sort of focusing on the on the incentives. I think the point we're trying to make is, there's these range of tensions, and actually the tensions are as important as the framework. The focus people tends to be on the framework. Get the framework right, identify what you want, get the information, get the solutions, everything's going to come out. Whereas actually the tensions overlay that in all organisations, whether they're acknowledged or not acknowledged, is not often sort of brought out. And I think what we're trying to do is to say they're intrinsic, they're there, they don't not exist, but they are often ignored, but they do have an impact on how these things play out in practice. I think they're in the information use bit, and again, on the circle, the third bit of the circle is the information use. So that is how, in that is how do the managers actually use the information and what do they do with it? So that's where the action sort of changes, and they use that again because information flows through, and you can either use it strategically and operationally. And there's always been a big question of how to link short-term operations to long-term strategy. But in my experience, you've got a general flow of information, some of which is for quick turnarounds and used by management iteratively to run the business. And other of it, accumulatively perhaps changes. It's the whole idea of whether strategy is emergent or developing. As the information comes through, that nudges the change of the strategy. So it's the in the paper, hopefully it'll be a bit more sort of detailed, but it's that interaction between the information production and use.
We are in
the...
We've got culture in there, which can be a bit of a catch-all. So, but that's a very useful observation.
Thank you.
And what time are we due to finish? Oh, we're on time. I'm thinking we were running late.
Hello, hi. Okay, fine. GSM London, Ron O'Brien. One of the things that's always struck me as quite curious about performance management or performance leadership or performance measurement or whatever you want to call it, but it really boils down to people doing the things you want them to do and getting properly rewarded for it. Do you see any usefulness in renegotiating targets and performance measurement? Because what's always struck me in both the commercial world and other worlds is we say everything is changing, we reforecast budgets, no problem, and yet we seem to stick to the same performance measurement targets. So in your example, there's a target around transportation costs, but then that is not useful in a particular circumstance. Do you see any room for constantly reforecasting, negotiating performance measures?
It's an interesting question, which, I worked for a US company the bonus programmes are effectively signed off by the board, so you can't change those. However, us, within our sales organisation, you know, if things were going not particularly well, we used to give them that break, but if they weren't going well, we would, to make sure they weren't demotivated and just didn't turn off, actually recalibrate their bonus targets and things, which were local things within our own control. So, yeah, absolutely. And it was a constant thought process and, where we could, action. Because, yeah, it's important.
It's a constant trade-off, isn't it? If you change too often, people don't know what the hell they're doing and where they're heading. If you don't change enough, then obviously you get the problems that you referred to. Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah.
So
I actually think people are more used to
change. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Our target
says we've finished.
Yep.
We've
met our KPI.
Okay, so we now move to the second theme of the conference. We've never actually had two themes, I don't think, but the second theme coincides with CIMA's publication of its Global Measuring Accounting Principles. So the theme is Measuring Accounting Principles. The way we've structured this afternoon is that we're going to have Naomi Smith from CIMA speak to us about measuring accounting principles in practice. We'll then have a break. After the break, we'll come back and we'll listen to Temu Malmi, who's going to say a few words about an academic sort of conception of the notion of measuring accounting principles. After that, we do something that we haven't also done before. We tend to get participants at this conference tell us that they'd like to participate more because they're participants. So we are going to have small workshops. We'll be dividing you up into six small groups, and then you'll go off for half an hour and discuss the idea of measuring accounting principles, and then you'll come back and a facilitator from your group will present the group sort of findings. And then we close the day with Michael Cromwich, who will talk to us about management accounting change. So without further ado, Naomi Smith.
Good afternoon, everybody. Al, thank you very much for that introduction. So, Management Accounting Principles in Practice is the title. And I'd like to add in context. And that context, I think it's probably commonplace now to say, is the rapidly changing dynamics that are moulding corporate life. And that remark is, of course, almost cliché. But we do need to look behind it to try and discern what is really going on in order to establish the contemporary significance of management accounting to corporate life as both continue to develop. In the previous session, we were told, never mind the frameworks. But some frameworks are pretty good, and some of them endure. And of course, this year, in 2015, we're marking the 800th anniversary of the signing of Magna Carta, which sought to recodify both the legal and political arrangements for feudal society under King John. And three of its fundamental principles really do endure still to this day. One, that nobody is above the law, the executive ought to be held to account. Two, that we need to have basic rights for everybody. And three, that essential public services and spaces shouldn't be appropriated for private benefit. And Magna Carta's influence has continued throughout some of the following epochs, which I'll talk through now. Mercantilism, Merchants of Venice, the Industrial Revolution with its corporation of limited liability, the consequent divorce of ownership from control as authenticated by Berlin Mies, and of course the rise of a much more benign management culture as identified by Anthony Crossland. And then of course the much more recent developments, such as the privatisation of state-owned assets, the rise of regulatory agencies, and the advent of global multinational corporations. And the signing of Magna Carta at Runnymede in 1215 has prompted a new reformist age. And this will not be confined to the world of law and politics, but will have much more extensive ramifications, including the world of business. And this quick review of epochal change reminds us that change is always with us, revealing both up and downsides. Someone who spoke an awful lot about change was the famous philosopher Thomas Kuhn, who used the term paradigm shift to explain major path-breaking changes in science, whereby what he calls normal science is changed irrevocably by pioneering developments in newer revolutionary science, after which things can never really be quite the same again. And by the same token, I believe that contemporary corporate life is undergoing the same kind of sea change. A Kuhnian-type paradigm shift is taking place, to be seen in the coming together of what previously existed as two distinct parallel universes, only very briefly and tangentially touching one another. And I refer, of course, to the practices of corporate behaviour on the one hand, and the precepts of corporate governance on the other. And in recent times, no event has more starkly demonstrated the ills of poor corporate behaviour and the failure of corporate governance than, of course, the 2008 financial crisis. In a very perceptive analysis of the economic crisis of 2008, two Italian economists, Massimo Amato and Luca Fantacci, support this notion of a real fundamental change now happening. In their book, The End of Finance, they say that the crisis was not simply a malfunctioning of the subprime mortgage market, but that it was rooted in a much more fundamental change, and that the very nature of finance, they trace that fundamental change back to the origins, and I quote, not just to the neoliberal reforms of the 1980s and 90s, but to the birthplace of mercantile networks in the 16th and 17th centuries. And they go on to suggest that the challenges we face today must be tackled in fresh ways, not simply by tinkering with existing mechanisms, but rather by asking the more profound question of how institutions might be devised in which finance could fulfill its essential functions. They too recognise a Kuhnian-style paradigm shift when they see one. Capitalism, as we know it, is changing and is being forced to change. So turning from the lofty heights of sort of this macroeconomic analysis to the more prosaic one of microanalysis, we have to examine how the accountancy profession is going to respond to these challenges confronting us. How do we maintain our relevance? Now, the various professional bodies are all considering this, and for its part, CEMA, and I can only speak on behalf of CEMA, has produced, after very rigorous research, which included a 90-day public consultation, a new set of management accounting principles that seek to demonstrate the value of the profession to organisations of all sectors and sizes and geographies. Like most institutes, CEMA is constantly engaging in research to make sure that its syllabus, its professional qualification, and its continuous professional development products are relevant to business. We're in the game of trying to future-proof our members' careers. And as part of our research to update our syllabus, we spoke to hundreds of organisations in a one-to-one capacity and to thousands through surveys and roundtables. And what became very clear to us during that research was that management accounting varies hugely both between and within organisations in terms of the standard to which it's done. When I say it varies within organisations, particularly those that have grown by acquisition and have inherited legacy systems and processes and cultures and ways of doing things, they may have had pockets of excellence in some areas and be poor in others. And what we were very much hearing from the market was that there was just no mechanism and no way to understand whether or not a management accounting function was effective. What was a sort of baseline level of what good looks like and what should be expected? And then the next 2 years of my life was spent working on the principles to try and establish that. And that's going to be the main focus of this talk. So in doing that research to develop the management accounting principles, we started from a position where we believe that all organisations share an ambition to be successful, and that all successful organisations have effective management accounting functions. But what is an effective management accounting function? And that's what we were really trying to get to the heart at in the work that we did to produce the principles. Most organisations prize asset is their people. And so that's what we believe is the absolute cornerstone of an effective finance function. Highly skilled, highly competent people. But that those people are also adhering to principles as they seek to improve the performance of the organisation through their areas of practice. In your delegate packs, you should have received a copy of the principles, and you'll see that that's exactly how we've structured that document. First, we talk about the competence of people, the skills that are required, that they need to have a very good technical basis to their knowledge, but that that is definitely not sufficient, and that they need to be able to apply that knowledge, that technical understanding, in the context of the business, while leading people to better outcomes for organisations. And so to be successful over the short, medium, and long term, you require excellent management of performance. And again, this is about people and their decisions and their actions and their behaviours being as good as they can be to drive the best possible outcomes. And these decisions are very much improved when rooted in principles and a framework. As Magna Carta did for law, a framework helps you to know why you're doing what it is that you're doing. A framework brings things together. If you think of a body, if you think of a skeleton, it's the framework that is holding everything together. It's allowing you to have all of the systems interconnected so that you can do different things at different times. And so there are four fundamental principles of management accounting. They're very much designed to demonstrate the value of management accounting to organisations, but also to help the individual management accountant to add the most value that they can in their organisation. So if there is a buzzword for this session, and I'll probably say it hundreds of times during the next few minutes or so, it really is the word value. And we believe that value is co-created through multiple interaction in multiple forums. So that's why communication is absolutely critical and is there in the top left-hand corner, enabling varied stakeholders to try and align their interests. Because conversations should provide insight about decisions and action to create value. And that insight is created from relevant information and the rigorous analysis of that information. And trust is ensuring that value co-creation can take place. So you have this cycle of communication, information sharing, and interactions that build trust and through which the creation of shared value can take place. So management accounting really does begin and end with conversations. Communication needs to provide insight that is influential. Communication that's actually driving action. So there are three important words: communicate, insight, and influence. And that's because communication is an outcome, not an activity. How many of you have written a report that has made one of your colleagues say, wow, that's just incredible, now I get it? Or how many of your colleagues will say to you, Naomi, you know that report you produce for me at the end of every month, it's hugely long, I just couldn't do my job without it. Earlier, Rick said that this principle doesn't pass the not test, that people wouldn't produce irrelevant information. I would absolutely beg to differ, and I know that I receive an awful lot of irrelevant information. Reporting needs to engender conversations. The average annual report is now something like more than 300 pages long. It's more of an industry than a provider of information, and I would say that most of those pages probably are not relevant to the users of those reports. So in order to engender conversations, communication needs to be tailored. And it needs to be tailored not just to the decision that's being made, but also to the decision taker. And the International Integrated Reporting Council will often promote this. They'll say that there are all types of stakeholders that you need to be engaging with: employers, customers, suppliers, business partners, communities, and others. And of course, each of them needs a different type of communication at a different frequency. But reporting information alone rarely drives influence, because for that you really need to be communicating insight. What do we mean by insight? Well, somebody said to us recently that it's like a refrigerator. The moment you open the door, the light comes on. That flashbulb moment. Aha, eureka, I've got it now. Another definition is that it's a penetrating vision into the heart of things, reaching beneath the surface and outside of conventional boundaries to grasp the essence of what must be done. So once you've provided a penetrating vision that gets into the real heart of things, you'll begin to have influence over the decisions that are being taken. But where do you look for insight? Well, a recent Harvard Business Review article found there are 7 places that you could look for it. You can seek it out in anomalies, examining deviations from the norm, what's lying at either end of that bell curve and why. Confluence. Where's the intersection of macroeconomic trends? Where are they overlapping? What's going on there? Frustrations. You can find insight in understanding deficiencies in the system. What's causing bottlenecks? Inorthodoxies. Not accepting the status quo. Looking for insight by questioning conventional beliefs. Critical thinking. Not taking everything at face value. You can also find it in extremities, exploiting deviance. Through voyages, immersing yourself somewhere else, learning from other places. Similarly with analogies, borrowing from other industries or organisations. I think, for instance, low-cost carriers have learned from Formula One pit stops. How do you really quickly turn an aeroplane around so that you can sweat that asset and get it out flying as many times a day as possible? So insight really helps us to communicate with influence. Aristotle, he talked about persuasion and the things you need to be able to persuade and influence, and he located 3 things that you need. He said you need ethos, which is the credibility to be delivering the information that you're trying to give somebody. You need pathos, an understanding of the stakeholders that you're trying to engage, getting them engaged in the decision that you're asking them to make a decision on, and logos, from which logic extends, which concerns the quality of information. And so that brings us into the second principle of information is relevant. And insight is derived from quality information. But what does make information relevant? Well, it's relevant if it's of interest to you. Value analysis, which I'll come on to in the next principle, is where you will keep somebody's interest. But it's in this principle that you're going to attract somebody's interest, because it's the provision of relevant information where you'll gain their attention. I'm sure many of you will have travelled through a station to get here today. There will have been an enormous amount of noise. There will have been all sorts of people talking to one another about where they were going. There was probably an announcement over the tannoy from somebody saying that another line that you had no intention of taking was now out or delayed or something. None of it was relevant. It was noise. There was no signal there. But if somebody had called your name out, if you'd suddenly heard from all of that din somebody say your name, well, that's relevant to you. It would have piqued your interest. Why? Is that somebody trying to find me? Is that something I need to know more about? Your interest will have been piqued and you will have wanted to explore more. We are very much in an information-rich and knowledge-poor age. Digital age. We're often told about the volume and velocity of information and transactions which we are trying to deal with on a daily basis. Google's Eric Schmidt has sort of famously quipped that as a species we now generate the same amount of information every 2 days as we did between the dawn of civilization and 2003. Okay, so that's every single day we're producing petabytes and petabytes of data. And we're all accountants in this room, we've all got good head for figures, but the number of zeros you're putting on that just sort of gives you brain ache. Where is the signal from the noise? Well, good management accounting should help you do that. It really should help you to differentiate the wood from the trees, because it forces us to ask questions of that information. Questions like, is it topical? Is it novel or new? Is it information I can rely on? Is it even information I can understand? Using an example from the aviation industry here, in the average cockpit, the number of pieces of information coming into an aircraft during a flight, 3,900 pieces of information. Thankfully, most of that is not relevant to the person trying to keep that plane in the sky. And the vast majority of it is going back to the engine makers, to the manufacturers, or to the maintenance teams on the ground, so that the maintenance, repair, and overhaul people know what they need to do with that aircraft when it arrives. The pilots actually only need about a tenth of that information, and of that, the vast majority is rarely used. They're not having to use it often during a flight. They're actively using around 120 pieces of information, but at any one time, they're only focused on six key metrics. So the relevant information has been distilled from that 3,900 down to six. In a more business-friendly example, the type of information will be relevant to different people at different times. So at a corporate level, you might be much more interested in market share and only really need to have that information a few times a year, versus the department manager who may even daily or hourly want to know about machine downtime. So that's relevant information, and having had conversations, communicating and understood the decision at hand, and having sourced the most relevant and accurate information, it's then time to analyse it and to understand the impact that a particular course of action will have on an organisation's value. Lord Leverhulme, a founding father of the Cost and Works Institute, Seamus Forbair, has been attributed to this quote, but so has a chap called John Wanamaker, and I didn't want to misattribute anybody, so I put them both down, but has said, half of my advertising is wasted, and the trouble is I don't know which half. And to understand the cost of everything and the value of nothing does not a good management accountant make. So in this principle, it's really trying to understand the drivers of value, what is working, how should we allocate resources for optimal outcome. And when we talk about value, it really is in its widest sense. It's not just about profits, it's not just about market values or hidden intangible worth, not even just about the undisclosed intangible worth. It really is about value in its widest sense, about understanding the concept of organisations collaborating to create value, their value proposition, Who are we delivering value for? How are we capturing it and for whom? How are we creating it? And it's this concept of understanding each other's value proposition and shared sense of community that means we won't be acting in opportunistic ways that will harm future value creation, because therein short-termism lies and fails us all. So creating value through the business model, well, you're taking inputs from the capitals, and the integrated reporting model would tell us that those capitals aren't just financial, they also include manufactured, human, intellectual, social, and natural. And you're taking those capitals, and through your business model, you're transforming them through your activities and interactions to produce both outputs and outcomes that over the short, medium, and long term are either going to create or destroy value for your organisation, your stakeholders, wider society, and even the environment. Here's an example from Mitsubishi and their report, where they do exactly that. They take those capitals and allocate them to their four key areas of activity: energy and environment, commercial aviation, defence systems, machinery and equipment, and report on the output of each of those. And this wouldn't, of course, be a business presentation if we didn't reference Michael Porter, who, of course, has very famously written about this move from shareholder value to shared value. The concept of shared value can be defined as policies and operating practices that enhance the competitiveness of a company while simultaneously advancing the economic and social conditions in the communities in which they operate. Shared value creation focuses on identifying and expanding the connections between societal and economic progress. And he also says that not all profit is equal. Profits involving a social purpose represent a higher form of capitalism, one that creates a positive cycle of company and community prosperity. So the aim very much is to end up in this space where we are co-creating value for and with society. And here are some of the benefits of engaging different stakeholders in different ways. So engaging properly with your customers will help you have customer loyalty and improving sales. Investors, you know, in giving you better access to capital, helping you to reduce your cost of capital. Engaging properly with employees, meaning you've probably got a more productive workforce. And again, some examples of organisations that are actually doing this and reporting on it. Ericsson, down here at the bottom, they say, through engagement, we maximise our ability to create value for society and impact the issues of greatest mutual concern. And a full list of our stakeholder engagement activities is available. And another example here is from Deutsche Post, the world's largest courier company. The red blobs on this sort of heat map are the stakeholders for whom Deutsche Post believe it is absolutely critical to be able for them to operate. If they don't manage these relationships well, they'll lose their mandate from society to be able to exist. So they're actively managing relationships with unions, rating agencies, policymakers, competitors even. And so you can be a phenomenal communicator with the very best, most relevant information, which has been analysed using the most cutting-edge techniques. But if you aren't trusted, you won't be listened to, and nobody will be persuaded by your recommendations. So why should we bother about trust? Well, you can negotiate better business terms when you're a trustworthy organisation or an organisation deemed to be trustworthy. It helps you to enhance your innovation. You have a more engaged and loyal workforce, stronger external relationships across your value chain, all culminating in greater resilience to withstand any shocks and crises. An organisation called Edelman produced an annual trust barometer, and this is based on a survey of 33,000 respondents. So it's a very, very, very big survey. And this is their 2015 results compared to 2014. And trust has fallen amongst NGOs from 66 to 63%, among business from 59 to 57%, and with the media from 53 down to 51%. government, for some reason, has had a slight increase between 2014 and 15 in terms of levels of trust. That might be about to change. And academics, you're doing okay. So on the individuals, academics have stayed level pegging, 70% level of trust in them. CEOs, I'm afraid you're in real trouble. You're on the skids, and fewer than 50% of people trust you, and even less than last year. And again, it's back to this societal benefit, which is lying at the heart of why building trust is so vital. So 81% of respondents agreeing with this statement, that a company can take specific actions that both increase profits and improve economic and social conditions in the community where it operates. Okay, so that being a good corporate citizen and going after profit is not mutually exclusive. People do believe that you can and should be doing both. And again, reasons that trust in business is increased, 47% saying that it's because business contributes to greater good, and 53% of people saying reason why trust in business has decreased is because of a failure to contribute to that greater good. And this is really why it is so crucial for management accountants to act as stewards of the organisation's financial and non-financial assets, to balance these short-term commercial considerations with longer-term value, to be accountable, to be credible, and to be sustainability-minded. So I began by... I've been describing CEMA's principles, which is its contribution to the wider debate on better governance. It's modest in the wider scheme of things, but nevertheless helpful, and I'm absolutely delighted that they're already being implemented in a great number of the organisations that we work with globally and across all different sectors and different company sizes. And I began by referring to the philosopher Thomas Kuhn, whose notion of paradigm shift conveys what I believe is now happening in the coming together of the practices of corporate behaviour and better behaviour and notions of corporate governance. And I do think that this coming together is essential if public trust is to be restored to the workings of both the public and private sector of our economy and society. But I'd like to conclude by making reference to another philosopher, Baroness Honora O'Neill, who in her 2002 Reith lecture presciently examined the issue of the restoration of trust in both individuals and institutions. And she concluded persuasively, in my view, that we need intelligent accountability now, that we have placed far too much effort on external assessment and targets, which, while they have a role to play, if relentlessly pursued, will of course be ultimately self-defeating. And as Lord Leverhulme, one of CEMA's founding fathers, realised when mooting the creation of the Institute of Cost and Works in 1919, he realised that it's absolutely vital for organisations to maintain and develop their own internal day-to-day systems of performance management to prosper. And the Global Management Accounting Principles seek to help them do just that. Unlike Magna Carta, which was written by the English barons for the English barons, we've tried to practice what we preach in co-creating these principles. I mentioned earlier that we'd had a public consultation, but we're also very proactive in engaging with organisations all around the world, as well as our members, to pull these together. And thank you to everybody in this audience who may have responded to that consultation. I'm sure some of you did. We co-created them with our stakeholders, but also with academia and regulators, SMEs, large companies. And their utility does lie in the fact that they are already being used in different organisations the world over already. And we're going to continue to refine them and improve them over time. I hope you do enjoy reading about them, and I do look forward to hearing your feedback. Thank you very much.
And good you, Svetlana Kuznetsova, professor in management accounting, Alfred Nobel University, Ukraine. As you underlined, information is relevant, and we could describe our modern economy as digital economy. And in this case, could we describe information not only as relevant information, maybe more quality information or digital information? Because relevant is one feature of information. We could see transparency as a feature of information, and maybe reliable as feature of information. And what do you think about it? Maybe not relevant only, maybe quality and digital. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, in the document itself, where we talk about what we mean by relevant, we do touch on all of those issues around accuracy and accessibility, and not just simply relevance, but we believe that it can't be relevant if it isn't all of those other factors as well. So it's more of a headline than a standalone. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Nor from University of East Anglia. I'm struggling to see the difference between the global management accounting principles to what we have, what we already have in the field. Can you please explain to me further? Maybe I have a lack of understanding of what are the new things that's offered here. Thank you.
So, do you have another framework in mind or another? Sure. Okay, so thank you for your question. So it's new insofar as it's been brought together. Management accounting is not new. It's been done for many, many years in many different types of organisation. What we've never had before has been the bringing together of it into one framework and in a way that allows organisations to understand this is the baseline of what we should be achieving. So when we were talking to organisations, this is what they were telling us they needed, that actually there wasn't anything there for them to assess their current management accounting function. Where are the gaps? Where are the deficiencies? And that's why what we've done, and we did an extensive literature review, and we didn't find anything that was laid out in this exact way, which is an application of these principles to various different areas of practice and to different parts of the management control cycle, and in a way to explain the very fundamentals of management accounting. And how you apply those differently at different stages of the control cycle or during different areas of practice. So we're not trying to redefine management accounting wholesale. It's not about the newness of the profession or we're unveiling some new way of doing management accounting. The novelty lies in bringing it all together into one framework. And if you've seen something similar, please let me know, because we didn't find it during our research.
Hello, hi. Mine is a comment rather than a question. You said, Naomi, at the beginning, how many times do people say, wow, and that was interesting or relevant? Can I say just thank you very much for something that I am saying, wow, very relevant and very, very interesting discussion. Thank you.
I'm Jeremy Dent from the London Business School. Thanks very much for your presentation. I actually have had a chance to skim through your booklet on global management accounting principles, and There's two thoughts that occur to me, and one relates very much to the sort of discussions that we were having in our first session with Mark Wouters, which is how much of the management accounting function is no longer addressed to gathering information about what goes on with the firm, but gathering information about what goes on outside the firm. For example, competitor analysis, understanding competitors' initiatives in response to our own developments and so forth. And that seems to me a substantial shift in the training of accounting. They're no longer counting beans. That's kind of automated, at least as I understand it, it is, and much more externally focused, which means they need different skills to analyze what's going on in the marketplace and what their competitors are doing. That's one thought I have. And the second thought I have is that I was left with a thought after skimming through your booklet on global management accounting principles. Is there anything in management that is not accounting? It seems that you're staking a claim for accountants, which is not just about information, it's about decision making in virtually all aspects. The only bit that seemed to be excluded to me was reserved to HR professionals. But things to do with strategy, things to do with operations, things to do with pricing, things to do with capital investment, all seem to be the province of management accounting. Now, that seems to me a very, very Anglo-American way of looking at the world. In many parts of the world, there's accounting and business economics, and accountants wouldn't go near those sort of decisions. There are people called business economists who do that. And I wonder if you have any observation on the cultural specificity of the claims you're making for management accounting.
Thank you. So to address your first point, in the document we do talk exactly about that information has different attributes, and that increasingly there is a shift away from the financial to the non-financial information that is relevant, that it is not just historic data that is important, but also real-time analytics, and increasingly now anything predictive. And exactly to your point, that where management accountants are adding most value is not just simply looking at internal data, but looking beyond it to the macro environment, the operating context within which the organisation lies, and their value having that wider understanding and that umbrella view of the organisation and what is relevant. And to the Anglo-Saxon centricity point, we did this consultation in 20 countries in 5 continents. We had very consistent feedback from, we made sure that we didn't just go to Anglo-Saxon multinationals in those countries either. We held roundtables in West Africa, South Africa, Southeast Asia, North Asia, South Asia, Australasia, the Americas, as well as in Europe. So we did try our best to stress test what we were doing, and actually some of the really salient things that came out in the fourth principle around stewardship building trust has come from what we've learned from family-owned organisations in Asia, which do have a very different culture and much more of a focus on longevity and sort of 25-year plans rather than 5-year plans. So in terms of your point about is there anything that the management accountant can't do? Of course not. Yeah. but actually, I think you're touching on a similar point to the one that that Rick made in the previous session, which was that you're trying to stake a claim over an entire organisation. But what we're saying is that organisations need to make better decisions. You know, there is a crisis of leadership. Organisations are continually making bad decisions. Some of them are making great ones, but they can always be made better, and they can be made better by being evidence-led, by being rooted in the evidence available. And that might be forecasted future, based on predictions, but at least those predictions will be rooted in some kind of proper quantitative analysis, and not just finger in the air conjecture or marketing gut feel. So we would say that as business partners, management accountants do partner with every single part of the organisation. They should be doing all of that. We also have a chart sort of showing the expanding role of the CFO, and that they do increasingly now even have remit over HR, IT operations, as well as finance. But we did, for the purposes of the document, just stick to applying the principles to the core areas of the finance function. And to address Rick's earlier point as well about saying, well, you know, management accountants, no, they don't do tax. Well, even if they don't do tax, they contribute to tax. They contribute to financial reporting. The contribution that management accountants are making in providing the information for specialists and experts is growing, and the demand for them to be much more involved in that work we heard was growing. And that's why, as part of our consultation, we increased the number of practice areas that we'd covered from 12 to 14 to include things like internal audit and financial strategy, which people were telling us is taking up more and more of their time in terms of their contribution to those practice areas. Thanks. Tea time. You got a microphone? Microphone at the front?
Can I try and bring the two together? This one, the model, if you like, and the previous model. Clearly, major differences and so on. But they're both sort of saying, in a sort of ideal world, then these sort of things should happen. And then, of course, we had the really quite interesting case study. And it was very clear to me, if not to anybody else, that the firms involved in those case studies were scraping around, trying to solve today's problems, if not trying to save yesterday's problems, and hopefully will still be there the next day or two. I don't think they, either case studies, and I think a lot more firms, have any, have time or inclination to look at this model or the previous model. What I'm wondering is, as you're there, I'm going to ask you, but it's the same comment to me. How do you go from this rather beautiful system, your first firm and so on, to help firms like that? See what I mean? I mean, if I'm a firm in real crisis, you come along and say, global management came principles, that will solve my crisis. What I'm wondering is, how do you expect somebody in those sort of case study situations, basically a mess, to gain something from either this model or this? The models are there, but I would argue they're quite separable from the experience of the two case studies.
It may be unfair because I don't know whether you've served the case studies, but they're both down the chute.
So, yes. Well, I don't want to claim that if you were living and breathing these principles, crises wouldn't occur in the first place, because, you know, that's the nature of crises, and I don't think anyone's claiming that at all. But when you're faced with a crisis and it's immediate and you need to react, and you maybe don't have the information you need to make a decision, and it does fall back on judgment, if your judgment is at least rooted in principles, you've got a more chance of a decent outcome than if you didn't. And actually, you know, we would sort of say that this is much more of a tool for you to sort of diagnose and assess and find and identify areas of your finance function that need to be improved. We've had some excellent feedback from a major oil and gas company in Eastern Europe that have already run a kind of diagnostic using these principles, and they've highlighted a couple of areas where they need to allocate a bit more resource and have a bit more training for staff because they noticed a weakness. So hopefully that would sort of help in that crisis situation. But you're right, crises require judgment sometimes, and you don't have time to follow frameworks, but principles usually give you a good guide for how you should respond. Thank you very much.